अपरे वासुदेवस्या देवक्यां यचितोऽभ्यघात् अजस्त्वमस्य क्षेमाय बधाय चासुराद्विषम्। Sudev and Devaki prayed for you. You have taken birth as their son. Undoubtedly, you are unborn, yet you take your birth for the welfare, for their welfare, and to kill those who are envious of the demigods. Purport by His Divine Grace. Esi Bhakti Vidhan Swami Prabhupada. It is also said that Vasudeva and Devaki, in their previous birth as Sutapa and Prishni, underwent a severe type of penance to get the Lord as their son. And as a result of such austerities, the Lord appeared as their son. It is already declared in the Bhagavad Gita that the Lord appears for the welfare of all people of the world and to vanquish the asuras, or the materialistic atheists. Queen Kunti as an exalted and intimate associate of Lord Sri Krishna, one who truly exemplified pure and genuine devotion to the Lord in every respect, is for all of us the perfect role model of what a real and true devotee should be. Kunti Devi never complained. She never criticized. She never doubted Krishna in whatever he did. Krishna is the controller of all controllers. Nothing can take place without his sanction. Queen Kunti underwent so many great sorrows, so many crises and tribulations. By material evaluation, there was no cause, there was no reason why these things should happen to her and her children. It was the inconceivable will of the Lord. But Kunti Devi, with such a heart of devotion, she accepted whatever Krishna allowed to take place with such a loving and grateful heart, knowing that although naturally we become attached to the things and the people of this world, ultimately Krishna is our only refuge. To remember him and seek shelter of him is the only real truth in life. There is no other truth. Without Krishna and his shelter, everything is an illusion. So however much this illusory energy is transforming before our eyes within our life, we should know that the perfection is to seek shelter of Krishna at every moment, in every circumstance, in good or in bad, in health or disease, in success or failure, in happiness or distress, in life or in death. Our purpose of being in this world is to learn to seek shelter of the lotus feet of Sri Krishna by always remembering him with devotion in every situation of life. And those who find shelter at the lotus feet of Krishna, they understand, by the grace of the Lord, the unlimited, inconceivable qualities of Sri Krishna. Krishna is not subjected to anyone's conceptions. Krishna is unlimited. Krishna is fully independent to be what he wants to be at any time. If he wants to take the form of a giant tortoise, he becomes a giant tortoise, worshipped by all living beings. If he wants to take the form of a huge boar with such magnitude to lift the earth effortlessly within his tusks, he can effortlessly do so. If he wants to create all material existence within a moment, he can do. And if he wants to destroy it all, that is his will. So Krishna is inconceivable. And here, Mother Kunti is expressing this in this verse and the following verses. She is describing how great personalities, transcendentalists, learned scholars of the scriptures, self-realized souls, in their mature and ripened realizations, they describe the Lord in different terms, and they are all true. Why the Lord appears in this world? Why, how, and who he is? She's expressing that so many different great souls have so many different explanations. Just like an ocean. An ocean is so unfathomable that it can accommodate any amount of rivers, any amount of streams. So similarly, Krishna is so great, and whatever our glorification may be toward him, it is a very insignificant offering. It cannot in any way do justice to the fullness and the greatness of Krishna's true glories. Om Purnam Ada Purnam Idam Purnasya Purnamadaya. He is perfect, he is complete. And when he reveals himself in this world, he fulfills unlimited purposes for unlimited reasons. Krishna says in Gita, Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskritam dharma samstapanaradhaya sambhavami juge juge, that I come to this world to annihilate the miscreants, to give pleasure and protection to my devotees, and to reestablish the principles of religion. That is a very basic, general explanation. But we see when Krishna appeared in this world, he appeared specifically to answer the prayers of Devaki and Vasudev. He appeared to reveal his beautiful transcendental pastimes of Vrindavan. He appeared to give pleasure and protection to so many souls, each of them with a unique relationship with the Lord. So a real devotee is Mahatma, is broad-minded, can understand that according to Vedic authorities, there are oftentimes different explanations of the same principle, and sometimes they appear to be very contradictory. And sometimes we try to rationalize within our mind how they can somehow or other balance with one another and what is the real truth. But it is useless because Krishna is beyond the rational capacity of the mind. Krishna is inconceivable. There is a somewhat of a controversy that there is much debate about. Srila Prabhupada explains in his books in various ways how the individual soul, the jiva atma, comes into this world. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada explains very clearly, very succinctly, that we were once with Krishna, we were once engaging in Krishna's loving service in this spiritual world, and because of our minute independence as fragmental parts of the Lord, we misused our independence, we became envious of Krishna, we wanted to enjoy separate from Krishna, and therefore, to facilitate this, we have come into this material world where we have the opportunity to try to exploit independent of Krishna. At other times, Srila Prabhupada explains that it is a conclusion that no one can ever fall from Vaikuntha. That once going to Vaikuntha, one never returns. So does this sound like a contradiction? It appears to be a contradiction. On one hand, no one falls from Vaikuntha. On another hand, we fall from Vaikuntha. And previous acharyas explain also in various ways what is the truth of how the spirit soul comes into this world. But Srila Prabhupada explains very, very clearly that this cannot be understood by your mind, whatever theoretical explanation is there. And he warned us very carefully, he cautioned us, do not dwell on this matter, do not discuss this matter, do not debate or argue this matter. The fact is, we're here, it doesn't matter how we got here, the real purpose of life is to go back home, back to Godhead. Rather than wasting our time arguing about where we came from, we should be using that energy to go back home, back to Godhead. He used the example of the crow and the tal fruit. That the crow went on a tal fruit tree and the tal fruit fell to the ground. And some people say that it's because the crow landed on the branch that the tal fruit fell. And other people say, no, the tal fruit fell anyway, it just so happened that the crow landed at the same time. So there's great arguments whether actually the crow was the cause of it or whether he just happened to be there when it happened by its own natural course. Srila Prabhupada said, it's whatever reason, you pick up the tall fruit, you offer it to Krishna. You don't worry about all these things. It's not very important. The fact is it's here. Similarly, the fact is we're in this material world. We're suffering repeated birth and death. Prabhupada would often use the example that if you're a diseased man and you go to a doctor and you ask the doctor, please cure me, and he says, I want to know exactly when you were diseased, how you got diseased, you say, listen, just give me the cure. I'm not concerned about all these things. Drowning in the ocean, if someone throws you a rope, you don't question, when did I fall into this ocean? How did I fall? Why did I fall? You take the rope, you get out. These things are inconceivable. And the acharyas and the scriptures explain in various ways. And it is not that one is right and one is wrong. Because when we speak about the inconceivable world and the unlimited nature of God, one time they asked Prabhupada, there is an argument. Some people say we fell from the spiritual world. Some people say we fell from a place lower than the spiritual world. Which is right? He said, they're both right. But you cannot understand. So therefore, and Prabhupada explained, by your rational intelligence, you cannot understand what is inconceivable. You simply have to accept with faith what Guru Maharaj is saying, and you must simply repeat as he is saying with faith, and by doing that you please Krishna, and by pleasing Krishna you go back home, back to Godhead. But by speculating and using your own fertile brain to give your own opinion, your own conclusions, you displease Krishna, and you'll never figure out what the truth is, and at the same time, you'll remain here in this material world speculating birth after birth after birth. So the absolute truth is beyond our conceptions. We must simply hear from Guru, hear from Sadhu, hear from Shastra, and accept. Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshantite jnanam jnaninastatvadarshana. The Guru speaks, but everything the Guru says must be confirmed by Shastra. But at the same time, the Shastra is so broad, it is so inconceivable. Therefore, we require the disciplic succession. And if the spiritual master is properly representing the disciplic succession, we just accept what is his version and understanding of the Shastra, because you cannot understand yourself. If the spiritual master is properly situated, if the great Vaishnav we are learning from is properly situated in parampara, we just accept what he says. You cannot go beyond him to try to figure out what he really means. Because if you do, you enter into the realm of your own speculation. And Srila Prabhupada was very careful to teach us according to this line. When devotees inquire from us, which side of this debate do you take? I can only say Prabhupada's side. He said both. So just accept both and chant Hare Krishna and become purified. And don't worry about these things. Don't write books about something Prabhupada said not to discuss or argue. Don't make an issue over something Prabhupada said you'll never understand. Because there are different explanations. And how all of these various explanations can be true simultaneously, although they appear to conflict and contradict, is because these truths ultimately are absolute, and they are beyond our limitations of the mind. We can make so many rational adjustments to try to intellectually prove how they relate to one another. But ultimately, we simply have to accept. This is how Guru Maharaj explained it. This is how we accept it. So Queen Kunti is explaining so many apparent contradictions. Some say, Krishna, that you're unborn and you came just to please King Yadu. King Yadu, you know, he was the son of Maharaj Yayati. And when Maharaj Yayati fell in love with Damayanti, it's a long story, but Shukracharya cursed him because he was unfaithful to his wife, Shukracharya's daughter. And his curse was in his youth. He was given invalidity in old age. So Yayati Maharaj decided that my children love me so much, I will give them the curse. Any one of them who will accept it, and then I could enjoy youth with my beautiful wife for many years to come. So he approached some of his sons. Sons, they said, what? You want to give us your invalidity? We're so young, so strong, so beautiful. Forget it. We don't want it. Sometimes a father thinks that he has so much, he has so many expectations of what the children will do for him. But we cannot be attached. This is evidence. Sometimes we have an only son and we're just expecting that they will take care of me for the rest of my life. And then they become brahmacharis. Beyond our control. What can we do? We tell them, what is this? I've raised you, I've put you through college, you are my only son. I'm depending on you to earn for me, to do everything for me. You are my servant, birth after birth. But then the son decides that, I am your servant birth after birth. By living as a brahmachari and chanting Hare Krishna, I will send you back to Godhead. I will liberate you to end this birth after birth. So some things that we expect are sometimes just beyond our control. So then he approached Yadu. And he said, you take my invalidity. It is the duty of a son. And Yadu explained, within his mind, he knew that Krishna was going to take birth in his dynasty. And therefore, if I take invalidity, there's no question of any children. There's no question of any offspring, so how will Krishna take birth in my dynasty in generations to come? So he disobeyed his father, which morally is a sin. To disobey your father is a moral sin. But for the sake of service to Krishna, it is a higher principle. And therefore, Yadu is celebrated and glorified for disobeying Yayati because he wanted to help in Krishna's divine plan. But then, of course, there was Puru. He said, yes, give me your invalidity, the eldest son, the youngest son. And he accepted it. So Puru is glorified because he followed his father's word even though it created such disastrous, painful suffering in his life. And Yadu is glorified because he disobeyed his father's word for the purpose of the higher goal of serving Krishna. And the other sons who disobeyed for their own purpose of sense gratification, they are condemned. So Yadu is such a great soul. And Kunti says, some say that you were born, although you are unborn, for the glorification of pious kings. Some say that you came to please Maharaj Yadu. Some say you came because Vasudev and Devaki prayed for you. Others say that you came for the welfare of Vasudev and Devaki, to save them from their persecution of Kamsa. Others say you came to kill those who are envious of the demigods. Others say that you came because Bhumi, Mother Earth, who came as a cow, who was feeling such a great burden, you came to lift that burden and to diminish the trouble of the earth. And others say that you come to rejuvenate devotional service by hearing, remembering, worshiping, in order that the conditioned souls can get liberation from the pangs of material existence. And sometimes there are arguments between people, but the real devotees understand that Krishna can fulfill all of these purposes simultaneously, because Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he has a chintya shakti. He has inconceivable potencies. Queen Kunti did not engage in any debate of who is right or who is more right. She simply accepted. And this is the process of real transcendental knowledge being disseminated. Pariprasnena sevaya. To be submissive, to simply accept. To simply accept with faith from the proper source, and to understand that yes, there may appear to be contradictions, but they are all resolved through realization. Just like one time in Toronto, Canada, some of the biggest professors of Indian philosophy and Sanskrit study came to meet Srila Prabhupada. And they had studied so much the books of Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Shankaracharya, the various Goswamis in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And they decided to ask Prabhupada a question where they wanted to have a very, very deep philosophical dialogue. They said, Swamiji, amongst the great acharyas who you accept as authority, there are so many contradictions in their teachings. And Srila Prabhupada became very grave, and he looked at them, and with a very bold voice, he said, amongst the acharyas, there is no contradictions. But because of your small, insignificant mind, you are seeing so many contradictions. Because in this relative world, we should know that the absolute nature is beyond rational ability to grasp, ultimately, and there will naturally appear to be so many contradictions. Just like amongst children, sometimes there's so many arguments, who is right, who is wrong. 3 plus 1 is 4, 2 plus 2 is 4, who is right? even in the relative world, we understand that the higher we go, the more inclusive our intelligence is. In a similar way, in the absolute realm, there is no question of trying to judge it by material resources. It's impossible. We have explained many times in Krishna's Leela, certain things are just incomprehensible. How King Ugrasena had so many trillions of bodyguards living on the island of Dwarka. According to the Srimad Bhagavatam, there were quadrillions of people living on Dwarka. And it also describes the size of Dwarka. It was only a few miles. Huh? Hardly 100 miles. And yet there were trillions of people living there. And there was no population problem. So here in Bombay, there's a mere 12 million people living. And yet there's so many problems with traffic jams, so many problems with overcrowded, not enough housing, not enough sanitation facilities, not enough transportational trains, buses, so many problems. But for Krishna, what is the difficulty? Krishna is absolute. So when we hear that there are trillions and trillions of people living in a small island, we don't try to rationally understand, well, how did they make the sewage lines so there were toilets for everybody? How do they have enough water? Because all around is the ocean, it's all salt water, you can't use it. So how did they have enough fresh water for everyone to take 3 baths a day? Because in those days, the people followed these standards of 3 baths a day. How did they, what do you call, village planning? How many plots for so many people for square inch, for square, huh? If you start thinking like that, you will die. There's no way you can possibly accommodate. But if the Bhagavan says, trillions of people on this island, you just say, Harivo, Krishna. Krishna can do. What is the problem? He is absolute. Because the spiritual energy is completely beyond the purview or the comprehension of the material energy. You cannot even accommodate the idea of eternality as long as you have any attachment to this material body. We talk about eternity, but what does it mean? It's so theoretical, you cannot grasp it. We accept it, but we cannot grasp it. You cannot understand what is eternal until you transcend the temporary and reconnect with your eternal nature. It is impossible. It is all just words. But if we accept those words with faith and follow the process that is given to us by the great souls, then we can actually realize what is eternity. You cannot understand eternality until you are self-realized. You cannot really understand anything about Krishna until you're self-realized. Until then, we simply have to accept with faith and follow the process. And not be in anxiety about certain things that appear to be what we don't want them to be. Appear to be something that doesn't fit within the little box of our conception. Because in spiritual life, It is full of surprises. As soon as you have some idea of an understanding, then all of a sudden, you realize that I thought I had it. I thought I had it in the palm of my hand, in my fist. But it is something way beyond. We cannot put Krishna in our fist. We cannot understand Krishna with our minds. But with faith, with devotion, Krishna reveals himself to you. And as he reveals himself to you, we can understand that his greatness can accommodate so many inconceivable properties that are beyond any explanations by moral or rational conclusions. And this is very important. At the same time, we cannot accept the speculations of others. We accept truth from those who have humbly accepted the truth as it has come down through disciplic succession. We never accept truth from those who are speculating with their own fertile rational brains of what it is. So do not think that because Krishna is unlimited and includes all various apparent contradictions, that we can just listen to anyone with any of their speculations, and Krishna accommodates that. That is also a deviation. People think, anyone can say anything. Anyone can speculate any way they want. And it's all true, because there's no contradictions. Everything is one. But this is nonsense. We must reject the speculations of those persons, however intelligent and scholarly they are. We must reject it. Because their truths are within material energy. But we accept from those who have accepted as it is. And then we should know that the information we are getting is pure, it is true. Is there any questions?
Maharaj, we know that the cowherd boys enjoyed a friendly relationship with Krishna. The gopis enjoyed a conjugal love relationship with Krishna. What is the relationship that Queen Kunti shared with Krishna? Because sometimes she is glorifying him as the Supreme Lord, sometimes she is appreciating the childlike qualities of Krishna. So what is the exact relationship? Sometimes she is thanking him for saving her children from danger. So what is the exact relationship?
Is in Aishwarya Ras, which means that she is understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead with awareness of his supremacy as the Personality of Godhead. And as Krishna's aunt, she has a servitude relationship with him in parental affection. And she's explaining the glories of Krishna's Vrindavan Leela and explaining the glories of Mother Yashoda. So she has deep, deep appreciation, unlimited appreciation for the Ras of Braja, which is completely spontaneous. But at the same time, she's not in that Ras. She's appreciating it. She understands its exalted character. She even understands its superiority over Aishwarya Ras. But at the same time, because she is fully aware that Krishna is the unborn Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, the source of everything, she cannot, she is not, it is not that she cannot, but that it is not her nature to be able to experience the same type of spontaneous madhurya affection of Yashoda. So she has a parental relationship in a mood of service in Aishwarya Ras, which means that she is aware of his supreme glories. And therefore she has what we would, of the, not of the Goloka stature, but of the Vaikuntha, or Dwarka stature of devotion to Krishna.
Maharaj said the spiritual energy we cannot conceive, I mean it's inconceivable. But it's a truth, it's a Bible truth all over our, the world, that there are the solar system, the sun is there and the planets are going all around. So when we say this 14 planetary system, this becomes a real big contradiction.
14 planetary systems?
This is material, like they have seen it through the senses, through the telescopes. So it has been proved that they can see these planets, and here we are saying through the scriptures that there are 14 planetary systems. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are higher planetary systems, this is the earth, and there are lower planetary systems. So how do we go about in this situation when, of course, we can accept it because we have to accept it on faith. So, but a person who has no faith, he gets completely bewildered, and he may think that we are rationalizing.
14 planetary systems doesn't mean there are 14 planets. It means there are 14 systems of planets with many, many planets in each system, which are graded according to the particular type of consciousness of the people in each system. In other words, the 14 planetary systems accommodate 14 general types of karma for living entities. And according to our karma, depending on how sinful or pious it may be, just like in the upper planetary systems, Bhūloka, Bhūvarloka, these are the middle planets for people who, like us, who are essentially not suffering too much, not enjoying too much. The Swargaloka is the next planetary system, and that is where the heavenly planets are for people who are extremely pious, who people perform great, great sacrifices and yajñas, people who give immense charity, who are very selfless servants of humanity, very philanthropic and humanitarian in every possible way. And there's inconceivable luxuries, opulences, pleasures, long, long, long life, no disease at all, Swargaloka. And then there is Janaloka, Maharloka, Tapaloka. These are planetary systems for great sages, for great jnanis who have understood higher truths, for great mystics who have performed tremendous, tremendous tapasya. These planetary systems are not places of great luxury and opulence. Places where great sages reside, performing tremendous tapasya, who live for millions and millions of years with all the mystic siddhis, who enjoy actually pleasure far beyond those of Swargaloka, because their pleasures are within. They're very highly liberated souls, rishis. And then there is Brahmaloka, where you have all the luxuries, plus all the siddhis and all the realizations. So in other words, these various planetary systems are for people with different types of karma. And these are not things, these are in the higher realms. we should know of this material existence. It is the gradations of these planets, the structures of the planets, are on the basis of consciousness. Telescopes, which are made of various types of glass and lenses, you cannot perceive, you cannot understand. It is impossible. Srila Prabhupada even explained the moon. With our telescope, we look at the moon, and what do we see? We see craters. We see isolation. We see no life at all. But the scriptures tell us that the moon is a heavenly planet. And Soma, the god of the moon, is the king of that planet. And it is explained in the scriptures, there are descriptions of the moon planet. Profuse vegetation. In fact, even the vegetation of this world is depending on the light of the moon. Profuse vegetation. Beautiful, beautiful palaces. Wonderful, wonderful. Excellent opulences of all varieties. Why can't we see it through our lenses and with our eyes? Because to attain that state, you have to have a certain consciousness. You have to have certain karmic qualifications to see it. Unless you have the karma to attain that state, you cannot see it. By Krishna's arrangement, you can see the planet, but you cannot see anything within it. You cannot see its real nature. Because we don't have the qualification. We don't have the proper karma. That could be understood even in this world. People see the same thing in different ways. If you look at something with your eyes, you see something. If you look at it through a microscope, you see something completely different. Right? When I just look at my hand, I just see this. But when you look at it through the microscope, you see so many cells. It doesn't look anything like what we see. And if you look at it through a more intense microsome, you don't even see the cells, you just see little molecules moving around. So this is matter. According to our particular depth of perception, we see something completely different. Correct? Now you look at your hand, you look at under a higher power microphone, will you recognize that it's your hand? So similarly, our vision in this regard is determined by our particular karmic state of consciousness, that we can perceive things, the same thing in a different way. And this is the way the scriptures explain. Therefore, to understand the universe from the grossest possible form of ignorance in sense perception, with our telescopes, we are seeing. We cannot deny, we cannot say it's not true. But it's very, very, very primitive. We could look through a telescope, but unless our eyes have the qualification to see what's really there, it doesn't matter how good the telescope is. So in one sense, it's not contradictory. What the scientists are seeing in their telescopes, it's true, within illusion. They're actually seeing from a point of view of being immensely covered by illusion. They are seeing the world from the point of view of tamaguna, ignorance. With very low karma, they're seeing the universe. But we can see the same universe in higher states of consciousness in a completely different way. but the scriptures are explaining the universe from the point of view of the self-realized liberated souls who are empowered by God to describe it. Therefore, their explanation is perfect. It's not that it is a contradiction between the scientist's explanation and the Bhagavat's explanation. It's not a contradiction. It's just different levels of perception. One is within the realm of ignorance and illusion, and one is within the perception of pure vision, liberated consciousness. Therefore, one is truth in the realm of truth, and the other is apparent truth in the realm of ignorance and illusion. Does that answer your question? If those scientists came in with their microscopes and started analyzing his body, they would probably just see marble. And they would start analyzing what type of marble, where it comes from, right? Do you agree? These same scientists who are looking at their telescopes at the universe, if they came and we asked them, analyze Sri Radha Gopinath, they would come with their scientific tools and they would, oh, this is a particular type of marble. They would label it with a particular name, and like that. But are we seeing like that? Premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena. Because you have devotion. We never even think that they're marble. It's Krishna. We're actually seeing the beauty of Krishna. When the scientists look at Krishna, at the deity in their microscopes, of course we would never let them do it. But even if they did, would they be shedding tears of joy? They would just, like this, data. They would just be taking data. We're weeping in love when we see the beauty of the deities. Our hearts are attracted. We lose all attraction to everything of the world when we see the beautiful form of Sri Radha Gopinath. And that's your particular state of consciousness. But as you become higher and higher in your devotion and your consciousness, then you will see Radha Gopinath, you will see their beauty infinitely sweeter and more beautiful than you can ever expect to see now. What the materialistic people call a slab of marble will actually be talking to you. You'll see them moving and dancing. You'll hear them playing their flutes. So who's right? From the material perception, when they analyze the marble, you can't say they're wrong. They come up with the right analysis of what type of marble, what it is. But it's truth within the relative form of ignorance. But when devotees are dancing and crying and laughing and serving, giving their lives. If someone comes to attack the deities, a devotee is willing to give up his life to protect them. You think a scientist would be willing to give his life to protect a piece of marble? Because there's reciprocation of love. So it is the same principle. There's material perception. And within material perception, there is so many gradations according to karma. There's tamaguna, rajaguna, sattvaguna. And there are so many gradations of due to mixtures of these modes of material nature. And they influence our whole perception of everything. And then there is perception that is beyond the modes of material nature, which is bhakti or devotion. So yes, when they come up with their calculations, we don't care to argue with them. We just understand that it is their calculation according to their state of consciousness, but we don't care for it. Because there's no elevation, there's no purification by hearing from them or understanding what they say. Therefore, we simply accept what the great liberated souls say, who are seeing from a point of view that are beyond the eyes. Then we can understand what is what. Acharyopashanam. One who understands from the acharya, who is simply presenting the word of God, he understands what is what. Nobody else can understand what is what. So therefore we see through the eyes of the scriptures. We see through the eyes of Gurudev. We don't see through our own eyes or through the eyes of other speculators or materialistic people. One more question.
Maharaj, you said in the lecture that one should base his faith on the basis of Guru Sadhu Shastras. And see that he is in a disciplic succession. And the Guru repeats whatever is there in the scriptures, doesn't change anything. And the one thing which quite bewilders many people, and especially me also sometimes, is that like when Prabhupada went to the West, that time his Guru Maharaj had already instructed disciples to chant 64 rounds. And then when he went there, when he asked his disciples, they initiated. Because the disciples said that they cannot chant 64 rounds, he said, okay, 32. But even when they were not agreeing, they said, okay, 16. Like that. So he came to 16 because the disciples were not ready to chant 16 rounds. And that has become a standard for us now. And like this, so many other things, like for example, giving sannyas at the age of 29, 30, not seeing the qualification also, which
now... First of all, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati did give sannyas to a young man. Second of all, another question of Prabhupada explained things in different ways. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he also explained things in various ways. For instance, to some he said chant 64 rounds. Now, according to some of the closest associates of Bhakti Siddhanta and according to Prabhupada himself, often Bhakti Siddhanta would say, if you have no other service, you chant 64 rounds. But if you're preaching enthusiastically, you chant at least 16 rounds if you're fully engaged in devotional service. And he even said for grihasthas who were working like asses, chant at least 4 rounds. And I know I have been to many Gaudiya Maths, and they tell their brahmacharis or sannyasis, if they're actively, dynamically preaching, to chant at least 16 rounds. And they say it's in the line of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. And for those who aren't doing that, they must chant at least 64 rounds. But Prabhupada's movement is a preaching movement. So he explained it in different ways at different times. But actually, he gave us just what Bhakti Siddhanta wanted. And he made certain adjustments according to time, place, and circumstance to make Krishna consciousness possible for the people he was preaching to. Such liberated souls, such great acharyas, they are giving exactly what the previous acharyas have given, but they are giving it a way that we can best benefit from that. That is their mercy. Does that answer your question? Hare Krishna.